This is fun. The FU Network.
Hey, Canada. Welcome to episode 11 of Matter of Fact. I'm Ishat Reza.
And I'm Professor S. Why don't we get started?
Today on the podcast, we're going to do another election special, but we're going to compare and contrast the different party platforms on a number of different issues. But before we start, what we wanted to do was go over one issue that keeps coming up over and over again, electoral reform, because this is an issue that Trudeau in 2015 said he was going to do something about, that this was that 2015 was going to be the last time that Canada was voting in the current system that we have, the first past the post system.
Right.
So people had an expectation that there was going to be something else, and that didn't come to pass. And so there are quite a few people who are unhappy about that on the left of center. And so we thought, let's just go through that issue on a bit more of a substantive basis. And that way people can be a bit more informed on, you know, what happened, what it all means, and maybe it can help inform their decision if they haven't voted already. So Professor S, why don't you start with telling us what are the different options when it comes to electoral reform? Like, first past the post is what we have right now.
Sure.
What else is there?
I mean, but the first question I would suggest everybody think about is, even before you get into the type of electoral system, it's what do you want it to be? Do you want an efficient electoral system in terms of a vote output, or an effective one in terms of representation and translating voter intentions into policy? So those are big questions,
okay.
Right?
What do you mean by vote output?
Well, do you want one that is simply one, a system that will just give you a number, like I got the most votes, therefore I win, right? Just simple calculation. Is that what you want? Or do you want a system in which there is more efficient or effective levels of representation? So vote output is simply, you know, three candidates running in a riding, and whoever gets the most votes wins. That's what we have right now under first past the post, right? It's a very efficient system. You just need a plurality, and it works wonderfully when you have a binary system, especially with two candidates. For example, if you look at the French presidential election or the US presidential election, for the most part, you have two candidates running, right? So whomever gets the most votes in first past the post, and that's pretty clear and decisive. However, when we're talking about the system that we have, the first past the post system, we're looking for a plurality, right, of votes. But that doesn't necessarily mean that a majority of individuals have voted for the candidate or the governing party, and it sometimes is not very conclusive. So if we look at multiple candidates in an election, in a riding, that reduces the threshold for victory. So you may not get a majority of voters voting for a candidate, and by extension, voting for a party with a specific prime minister. And I've got two examples for you. This one is from living memory, so we're not going back into the 1800s. In 1987, the provincial election in New Brunswick, when Frank McKenna was running to be premier of that province, the Liberal Party got 60% of the votes. Good majority, right? The PC Party got 29% of the votes, and the NDP got 11. Do you want to take a guess as to what percentage of seats the Liberal Party won in that election in New Brunswick?
Well, I'm guessing because of the way you framed it, probably they didn't get a lot, and maybe they didn't form government.
They got 100. They got 100%, the Liberal Party. They got 60% of the vote.
Oh.
They got 100% of the seats. And it was so preposterous that they had to take questions from the press gallery in order,
But see, why is that so preposterous? I mean, they had a majority of the votes, I mean, the majority of the popular vote, right?
So sure, but you have 40% of the population shut out. They have absolutely no representation.
Right.
So that's right. Just the one. I mean, yes, that's an extreme example, right? But that's just one example in which it can happen. Now, if you fast forward to today, you go to Ontario and you have the Ford government, and many individuals say, well, they don't represent a majority, but it's nowhere near as extreme.
And that's true. Yeah.
Right. So that's just one.
No. Well, see, and this is the thing. I find that case much more problematic because it was about 40% or less than, right? That
correct.
Voted for his government, but they have a majority and they can do whatever they want for the next 4 years. That I find more offensive than what happened in 87.
Well, I'm just pointing out, it's just the perversity of the system, right? So we need to be aware of what can happen. And that is an extreme case. So that's what we have now. We have pros and cons. It's very efficient in getting people elected. You can figure out a clear winner. But in terms of representation of different political views, viewpoints, that gets skewed in what we have. And that's the primary complaint of those who are center left, who are pining for electoral reform, right? Greater levels of diversity and representation of political views.
Okay, so what are the other options?
We have single transferable vote. Now, this is used in Northern Ireland, several Australian states, and it's used in Scotland as well. And it was one that was proposed in British Columbia as well. So single transferable vote, some people are confused by it, but I've resolved it to try and make it as straightforward as possible. So instead of electing a candidate for each single member riding like we have here, what voters do is they elect a small number of candidates in a local district. So for example, a district that you live in could be allocated three positions, right? Or three spots in the legislature. And so the argument is that individuals will be able to rank who they want in terms of preference. And this would cut across party lines. And what this essentially allows you to do is have a more reflective, diverse approach. Now, how does this work? This is the part where people get confused, so I'll try and explain it as succinctly as possible. So just imagine you have a district in which you have three seats, and you have five individuals who are running to be a candidate. So five individuals, only three seats. Through some formula, they set the minimum threshold to win a seat at 5,000 votes. So you rank your candidates who you want to be in order of preference, and whoever gets 5,000 votes is elected. Now, after the first round of counting, if there's only one individual who is elected and has more than 5,000 votes, they get their seat, but their votes, anything over 5,000, gets reallocated to the remaining individuals in terms of who those individuals ranked. And so this go through multiple iterations, and eventually people are eliminated and preference votes are allocated to individuals left in the race itself, to the point where...
And I guess, is that 5,000 threshold determined based on, you could only have three people who could surpass it if there are three positions? Like, you wouldn't end up in a situation where you have like four or five people who would get at least 5,000 votes, right?
No, I'm using... In some cases, these numbers have been used as the baseline. It depends on how the electoral commissions determine it. I mean, they'll have to go through and run the data and look at the constituency numbers and the populations and the voting electorate and figure all that out. But that's just, imagine if 5,000 was the baseline. So anytime a candidate exceeds 5,000, the excess votes are reallocated to the remaining candidates. And so we go
in the order in which they follow,
correct.
Right? Like
that
just seems weird. Okay.
Yeah. In the order in which they follow.
But then
follow.
Is that different? That like this system that you just described, this is different than ranked ballots, right?
It is. It is. It's another form of proportional representation. If we get into that, we'll go way off. But yeah, it is different. But this is just in terms of what's being suggested, this has been one of the preferred forms of electoral reform.
Canada?
In British Columbia, for example, this was one that they were looking at. The electoral reform commissions out there, they did a tremendous amount of investigation in terms of how it worked in Ireland and in Australia. And so it seems to have provided results that are commensurate with what voters want. So there has been very little backlash in terms of how the system has worked in that regard. Now, of course, there's a lot of learning to be done by both politicians and the electorate alike. It's not as simple as first past the post. We have to make nuanced choices, but it does give you the ability to choose across party lines. That's the key here. You're not just locked to a party.
Because you're ranking a number of candidates. That,
correct.
And presumably the candidate list is long. Like, you're not picking from essentially what we do, which is like a handful of people, right?
No, like
there
you
must
can
be
have
a very long list.
There's a list. I mean, some of the examples that I looked at in Northern Ireland, you had lists of like 13 candidates to fill four seats, right? So that's a lot of diversity right there. And so what it does is it puts the onus on the candidate to show themselves to the community as to why they're the best candidate for the community. And it allows for a greater level of, they argue there, I mean, we're talking about Northern Ireland, right? A place that's come out of civil war. Now, if they can make this work in terms of political consensus, what are we, you know, one could say, well, what are we waiting for? So that's that.
Okay. So this is one, so I've heard the STV thing, so this is very helpful that you've now taken us through it. Now, the other two things that you hear a lot of in the discussions is, okay, PR, so proportional representation, and then you hear ranked ballots. Now, is this STV thing a form of any of those two, or what? Like, explain
STV,
how those all
STV
relate.
Is a form of ranked ballot because we are ranking our candidates in whatever way we want.
Okay.
So let's make that clear. This is ranking. You have a preference and you rank them in your preferential order. So yeah, it is in that regard.
Okay. So maybe then let's move on to another type.
Okay. So the third one that I would float out was mixed member.
Sorry, what was the second?
The first one was our first pass the post.
About Yeah, that's status quo. Okay.
All right. So then we now, the third one is mixed member proportional representation. And what this is a combination of our first past the post and a combination of proportional representation. And they're trying to bring both efficiency in electing people and effectiveness in representing views into one model. Now, where is this used? It's used in New Zealand. We mentioned that a couple of podcasts ago. It's used in Germany. It's used in Scotland and it's used in Wales. So various variations of mixed member proportional representation are run there. So what we're essentially doing in this approach is you live in a riding and you get to, on one part of your ballot, vote for one local candidate. So you can do that politically or however way you want to do it. And then in the other part of the ballot, you have the option to select an individual or individuals who are representing the region as a whole. So you have both a local identification and you have a regional identification as well. So you're choosing candidates again from different parties, different viewpoints. So once again, we're having this approach that will allow people to, you know, not be tied to one specific party. And this is something that has been floated around as well in New Zealand. Like I said, it was brought in and then it was put up for renewal through a national referendum. I think it was 56 to 57% of the electorate voted to keep it. So I can't say that's conclusive in terms of voters being happy with it, but it seemed to work relatively well in Germany. But of course, the one drawback is one can say, well, you never have an absolute government. You have to work for coalitions and that leads to unstability.
Yeah.
And many people are opposed to that because, you know, you want stable government. You don't want to have look for grand coalitions. If you want another example of where countries are going through governments very frequently, look at Italy and their electoral system in that regard and the use of PR. I mean, governments fall, it seems like, every 18 months in that country.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, it just depends on what do you want your system to provide, right? Do you want it to be efficient and clean? If so, first past the post is it. But if you're looking for other levels of representation, greater diversity of views, such as those espoused by the Green Party or the NDP, then you're going to be pushed into looking at alternatives. And the two alternatives to what we have are the single transferable vote and mixed member proportional representation. So that's where we are in terms of major systems for electoral reform that are out there.
Okay. Now, interestingly, in Canada, because we had had these discussions, you know, obviously there are a lot of people who've been looking into the different systems. There was a study, a collection of essays actually, that was released last summer by McGill Institute that had looked into these different things. And what they said is that, you know, the preferred method, which was proportional representation for quite a few people, and including the parliamentary committee that was struck, And I'll get more into that in a second. But, you know, proportional representation was one that had been put forward as, you know, this one could be a workable thing in Canada. Right. One of the challenges there is this question that you mentioned of, you know, you end up with coalitions or needing coalitions in order for the government to function, but mm-hmm. they're not as stable because they do fall more often. It's hard to get that consensus in governing. But one of the things it also does is it allows smaller parties to have representation. And so that would mean, you know, the Green Party would probably have more representation, which, you know, may not be a bad thing, depending on your perspective. But then it also would mean parties like the PPC would also have more of a say and would have more representation. So it can give rise to more fringe parties. And sure. depending on the fringeness of them, you know, it can be a good thing or a bad thing. And what interesting thing that the collection of essays found that it proportional representation doesn't necessarily mean better democracy. And part of the problem there is that, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean more people turn out to vote, because it's, even though you would think intuitively that if people feel like every vote matters because anybody could get elected and, you know, could have be represented, it doesn't necessarily mean you get better voter turnout. You know, the coalitions don't last, as you mentioned, and the governments change quite routinely. And so then in terms of being able to enact longer term policies and so on, that can be a real challenge. So these things, you know, they each have their pros and their cons, right?
Absolutely. Like I said, it just matters. It just depends on what do you want? Like, what are your principles and your values of the electoral system that you want? And the key thing when we discuss it is, are you really going to address the issues that you think you're going to address by changing the system? And typically more issues crop up as we tinker.
Right. Or different ones. Well, exactly.
Or different ones.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess,
and actually, so in Canada, I mean, you alluded to the BC discussions. There's also been discussions about it in Ontario and PEI.
Yep.
And in no context has there been any successful move towards changing our system provincially or federally. So, you know, it's sort of one of these things where now when we look at in the context of the current election, you know, Trudeau certainly did make a promise in 2015. Personally, I think it was a bit of a naive promise because I guess he didn't really think through, well, exactly how are you going to determine what you want? I mean, certainly they put forward this parliamentary committee, but what ended up happening with the parliamentary committee is people got really upset. Like the NDP, I remember, was pretty upset initially. They're like, well, the Liberals have a majority on the committee, so whatever they want is what we're going to get. And I mean, they had a majority on the committee because they had a majority government. That's just how parliamentary committees are comprised.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the Liberals were like, okay, well, you know, to be conciliatory, they're like, fine, we will give up a couple of seats, and then that way, you know, Elizabeth May from the Green Party could be there, and I believe the Bloc was there too. So they gave that up. So they had a plurality, but not a majority.
Right.
And personally, I think that actually is what led to there being kind of a problem in the committee, because, you know, they did work together. A lot of good work was done in trying to do consultations and understand what the different options are, et cetera. They came back with a report. The report suggested that some form of proportional representation should be adopted, but we needed a referendum.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the Liberals were not interested in a referendum. You know, some are saying, well, they weren't even that interested in proportional representation. Like, they would have preferred something more ranked ballot. I think going into the election in 2015, if Trudeau wanted to make some kind of a promise on this, he should have just picked a system and said, you know what, this is a system I think works. What do you guys in Canada think? Vote for me if you want this, right? And I mean, maybe that could have been a better approach. Although
I think in retrospect, you're right about that.
Yeah, but hindsight's 2020, right? Like,
absolutely.
And so this didn't go the way they wanted. I do think they handled it, like, not in the best way when they kind of, you know, pushed it aside. But essentially what happened is there was really no consensus because the Liberals didn't want what the committee was essentially suggesting. They didn't want a referendum. And personally, I actually agree with that, in that referenda are not the best way to decide really significant policies. Like, I think having a plebiscite, which I think is more like a, it's informational for the decision makers, right? It's like you test the temperature of what the public wants, but you don't let them decide. And I think on an issue like this, or any significant public policy issue where people really need to understand the implications of what's going on, you need for there to be informed decision makers at the table. And I don't think we can just leave that, delegate that to the general public, especially given how much misinformation can be out there. And Brexit is a good example.
I was just going to say that.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah. So anyways, we can talk about that at another point. But anyways, my point is, I actually think they kind of got into this. They realized it wasn't going exactly in the direction that it, you know, would be good to be going in. And so then they kind of scrapped it. And now it's something that those who really wanted proportional representation in the public are upset at Trudeau for, and are saying that, you know what, we are not going to support you this time. We supported you last time. So, you know, too bad, so sad. We didn't get our electoral reform. you know, anything good that you did, we're not going to even bother giving you any credit for it. So that's sort of one of the unfortunate.
And that is the voters' right as well, right? They can.
It is entirely their right. They can vote for whoever they want and on whatever issues are important to them. But I think it's also important to realize that, you know what, there was, I think, a sincere effort. Like, I don't think he lied about it, right? Because some people are saying he lied about wanting to put this in effect. I think he sincerely meant it. He just, as they got in, it was unrolling, they realized that, oh, actually, it's not exactly going in a way that we can reach a consensus. It's going to be more divisive than anything else. So they kind of pulled back from it. And, you know, then we have what we have now. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, our system is what it is. And I think, well, people can decide whether that one issue is so significant to them that they're willing to entertain the possibility of a very right-wing conservative government in Andrew Scheer.
Well, like we said, it's their choice, their call. If electoral reform is that important, then people will vote accordingly, right? But historically, it hasn't been shown to be the most important thing. There are other bread and butter issues, as they put it, that are much more important from the perspective of the electorate, because these elections, you know, they're in cycles. They want to look at issues, and not very many people have got the patience nor the stomach to look into issues such as electoral reform, electoral quotas, principles, etc., when there's issues like healthcare, gun control, immigration, and other top of mind issues that they want these parties to address. But again, if people want to vote for that on that basis, that is their democratic right. So
it's entirely their prerogative. But speaking of other issues, I think it's a good segue. Let's talk about some of the other issues that are being talked about,
right?
And sort of compare and contrast the different parties and what they are offering. So did you want to start with?
I'll just flow, because it's just a bit of a flow here. We've been talking about electoral reform. Now, we know where the Liberals' position is on this, and we've just talked about it. Not quite sure what the Conservative position is on it. I've tried to look through their platform. If somebody can tweet at me and let me know, go for it. But I'm not quite sure. But the NDP and the Greens offer interesting takes on electoral reform. I'm just going to briefly hit on these two parties, because we need to know what other options are available, right? So for the NDP, I'm not sure how they want to do this, but they want to increase female representation and introducing legislation to encourage political parties to run more women candidates. So essentially affirmative action. I'm not quite sure how this is going to play or how they would implement it, but it's one of the ideas. They want greater gender parity, something that the Prime Minister tried to do in his initial cabinets going forward. And another thing that the NDP...
he did.
Well, I beg your pardon, he did. He absolutely did. I should rephrase that. He did do that. Two other quick points that the NDP want to do. They want to bring in the mixed member proportional representation system that we discussed earlier. And they would do it in their first mandate. And most interestingly, they would lower the voting age to 16. Now, some people are in favor of this. Some people are not, for various reasons, but we'll leave that, you know, unless you have something you want to say on it now, we can leave it and move on to the Greens. But there are pros and cons to that. Okay, so the Greens, they also want to lower the voting age to 16. They also, this is an interesting one, they want to mandate Elections Canada to develop a truth in advertising framework for campaigns so that we have the Commissioner of Elections to investigate citizen complaints regarding campaign advertising and imposing sanctions, basically for false advertising during a campaign or lying. So they want to...
You know what? That I would 100% be behind.
That is a really, really good amount, idea.
Yeah, amount of misleading stuff that we've seen in this election cycle, I would be all for that. And quite frankly, I think anybody should, like all of the parties should be, well, all of them except the ones who've been doing the misinformation, you know, I would assume would be on board with something like this.
Yep. And there's two other points that I think are really important. Take away the leader's right to sign candidate nominations and allow electoral district associations to play a greater role in who is nominated. Because after all, that individual is representing that riding. So this would eliminate the leader's veto in terms of who could run. Now there's pros and cons to that too, yes. They also want to ensure that this is our last first past the post election. And critically, they also want to institute by March 2020 a citizens' assembly on electoral reform. And, you know, presumably that would have research and work done on the type of system that citizens
would want. Who's done that though? That's the thing. Like they did that in BC, I think they had a very strong group that actually put out a whole bunch of things, right? And I mean, even in the federal thing, like there was so much work done.
Yep.
I'm not sure we need another one of those, you know? Like it's like just, they've picked their thing, you know, if people want it, I guess they can vote for it. But I don't see the point in just like going over it over and over again.
So those are just things. So why don't we throw it over to you? Those are just some points from two other parties.
Some differences between the two, yeah.
So why don't we throw it over to you?
Okay, so then maybe the next one, because I mean, it's sort of tied to that, because that's talking about like our democracy and so on. The Senate, which is supposed to be sober second thought. That was the subject of our very first podcast, if you remember. Right. The three parties are looking for different things. The first three, like I actually didn't look at what the Greens are saying about the Senate, right? But I looked at the CPC, the Liberals, and then the NDP. Mm-hmm. So what the CPC wants to do is undo the changes that the Trudeau has made and go back to patronage appointments. So they want to be old school with the Senate. And, you know, personally, I don't think that's really the way to go. If you look at the types of people who were appointed under the patronage system, not all of them, but specifically some of the more recent ones by Harper, I would not say that these are like model senators. Anyway, so then we get to the Liberals. They brought in the independent appointment system. And so the senators, anybody can apply and there's a committee that looks at them. So they, you know, that's the system that they want to keep. The NDP actually want to abolish the Senate because they see it as being dysfunctional. And in order to do this, it would require a constitutional amendment because the Senate is in the Constitution and it has all kinds of powers given to it by the Constitution. Now, the thing with the NDP, I find like some of their ideas, especially, you know, like the ones that you mentioned too with the female, increasing female representation and so on, I agree with that. I think that's a good goal to have. But it's sort of hard to understand, like, how exactly do they plan to do it? Like, some of their goals are just, you know, very aspirational, and it's unclear the steps that one would take. And I would say this one, too, like, in the current climate where you have got so many conservative provinces, does the NDP actually think that they would be able to realistically renegotiate the Constitution on, say, the Senate, when already two of the main parties are not agreed with, you know, this idea? They want to keep the Senate. They just want to do it in a different way. You know, the NDP wants to abolish the Senate. He'll have to negotiate with the provinces and get unanimous consent from them on this. Does he not think that in a negotiation of that nature, there would need to be some give and take, and that perhaps some of the rights that the conservative type provinces will want are going to be like making our charter less strong, right? So that it's sort of like you can't go into a negotiation wanting something without being able to offer something in exchange, right? So it's just sort of this naivety, I think, in terms of the suggestion. But in any event, that's what the NDP is suggesting. They want to abolish the Senate. I don't think it's very realistic. I mean, I guess that people can decide for themselves if they think that's a good idea. My personal view is let's work with the system that we have. And I think we should give the current system, the new current system, which is the independent senators, a chance to work, right? Like, we need to get rid of some of the older senators, you know, as they retire and so on. Like, maybe as we get more and more independent senators, we'll see a change in the way that the Senate does work, because it can work. There's no reason that it couldn't work. It's just that there was a problem with the patronage system.
Well, and there's that, and there's the partisanship issue also. Remember, Rona Ambrose wanted conservative senators to support victims' rights legislation, and they held that up not that long ago. So there's a huge issue with patronage, partisanship.
Yeah, the conservatives did.
It's a huge issue. Yeah. But you have to give it more than a couple of years. It's only been a few
exactly.
years.
Yeah, exactly, and
right?
That's it. I think we need the new system to kind of work its way for a few more years, and then we can see how that goes, and, you know, maybe some tweaks along the way, because there are certainly some things that I think in terms of some of the conduct of some certain senators. But anyways, all right, you go ahead.
We got one that we've looked at before. We talked about gun control a few podcasts ago, but once again, just to bring into sharp focus what the party's main positions are on gun control, and I'll start with the NDP. So they haven't endorsed, as the Liberals did, like a national handgun ban, but they've called for cities to be given more power to ban handguns. So they almost want to delegate that power and empower cities, municipalities specifically, give them the ability to ban them. Now,
I think that's also the Liberal plan for handguns.
It is, absolutely it is. It is also. Mm-hmm. And they've also made a pledge of $100 million over 5 years for after-school programs to prevent youth from getting into violence, noble causes, but
the root causes thing.
The root, but I think we need, if we're going to go that route to try and combat gun violence and gang violence and just societal breakdown, we need to be a little bit more aggressive and engage the provinces much more to push towards early intervention, because that's the key, right? So that's the NDP. The Liberals, we know they brought in Bill C-71, they expanded firearm background checks, and they've rolled out some more mid-campaign. They want to ban semi-automatic assault-style rifles and buy back that anywhere purchased. And like you mentioned yourself, they also want to give cities greater levels of power to restrict or ban handguns. They won't bring back the registry.
I would also say here, as part of C-71, the idea of investing in communities, like this root causes thing, is also part of their approach as well. So they're similar. I actually don't see a huge difference between the NDP and the Liberals in this, to be honest. I think they're very aligned.
Now, the Green Party, they're in favor of both handguns.
I think the one thing that the Liberals are doing also is the ban on the assault rifles.
Correct.
Isn't it? That's their new thing.
Is. Yeah. And speaking of that, the Greens are also in favor of both a handgun and an assault rifle, but they have an interesting approach. They would run a confidential buyback program so that if you have them, you can get rid of them. And that's one of their approaches. That's one of their main planks on gun legislation or gun control, like an anonymous or confidential buyback program. But let me move to the Conservatives and the PPC finally on this. So we know they oppose handgun bans, and they will repeal C-71. Now, this is where we're going back into the Harper era approach to tackling violence, where they would target gangs, they would impose 5-year mandatory minimum sentences on gang members, revoke parole, automatic bail. Now we're putting more pressure on the criminal justice system and the court system. And I don't see much in terms of expanding resources there. And that becomes even more important when you consider that many of these crimes can also be dealt with in provincial courts, and the funding levels there are not expanding to the rate that they would need to impose these policy changes. So we've gone back to, I would say, a heavy-handed approach involving more money for the police to combat gun and gang violence, but not trying to target the root, right? They're going for they're trying to address the outcome, but they're not going to the source. And so that's one problem that I find with the conservative approach to this. And turning to the PPC, any moves to make gun ownership more complex, they're opposed to. And they're also in favor of lifetime firearm certifications after proper vetting and training, as they call it. And they also...
ridiculous.
Well, I mean,
people change. I mean, come on, like over someone's lifetime from when they're 18. I mean, really? I don't know. I actually on the conservative one, there's also other things like that, you know, loosening some of the restrictions, right? In terms
yes.
of
well, we could spend a day on that, but you know.
Yeah. So I mean, so they're doing like they're taking a heavy-handed approach on the punishment side, but I think they're also making it less stringent in terms of owning guns, and they want to change the classification determinations. To take it away from the experts and move it to where the politicians to politicians to decide, which is so inappropriate considering
the
gun lobby.
Well, that's what the PPC want to do as well, right? They want regulation of firearms to be handled by Parliament, not the police or Cabinet, but Parliament. And that opens the system up to a whole host of improper or suboptimal decisions.
Like influence, like you could easily be much more influenced. I mean, I would much rather have the experts making these kind of determinations.
Yeah.
And if there are issues that need to be ironed out at that front, like, you know, focus on that. But I think that they're more independent and that would be a better place. Now, having said that, so it sounds like, you know, the PPC and the CPC are not the ones who are going to be going towards the stricter gun control. That's more going to be the Liberals, the NDP, and even the Greens.
Yes.
Interesting to note that some gun control victims' rights groups are saying that they actually support the Liberal plan on this, like that they find that that's the plan that suits their objectives. And you know, it's I mean, on the gun control issue, it's an interesting one, but I think I hope anyways the Liberals will be able to talk more about what they're planning on this, because I feel like it's getting drowned out, like this issue anyways, at least in these last few days of the election campaign, it's sort of being drowned out by some of the other issues, and some of them are like the fake issues, right? So
that's it
okay,
for gun control.
Next,
over to
that
you.
Was gun control. Okay, so next I'll do assisted dying. Mm-hmm. As you know, this was legislation that was brought in by the Liberal government. It's an inadequate legislation that was brought in because it didn't fully adhere to the Carter ruling by the Supreme Court that said that, you know, that people have a right to this, that you know, it infringes on their charter rights, not to be able to die with dignity. And so the Liberals brought in a regime that was actually quite tepid, but they have now said that they will strengthen it and make it more broad. I mean, assuming now they plan to actually be aligning it with the charter, which is important. So that's where they stand, that they will adhere to, because there was a court case there was a court challenge, and the courts have come back and said, no, the current law does not meet the constitutional threshold. And so the Liberals said they will adhere to it. They won't appeal the decision. So that's good. So that, I think, will be some changes if they get reelected. The CPC has not said what they would do. Specifically, they just said, oh, we'll review the court decision, and that was it. Like Andrew Scheer said that during one of the debates.
Right.
What we do know about the CPC position on this issue in the past is that they don't agree with it, you know, which is not surprising considering they have much more of a more conservative religious point of view on things. So chances are they won't make any further changes. There's even a possible chance that they would revoke things. We don't know. It's not fully clear. Their past policy positions have been that they do not support assisted dying. And so that's their position. The NDP will actually expand it further. They are open to looking at different options beyond even what is required by, you know, the constitutional minimum. That's the other side of it. There's quite a range here between the CPC through to the NDP and the LPC. I didn't actually look at what the Greens are promising on this one.
Okay.
Over to you.
All right. So I have a third one. We're just a very brief compare contrast of the approaches to taxation policy, specifically to individual taxes here. So we'll start with the Liberals, Conservatives, NDP, Green, and then we'll finish up with the PPC. So the Liberals, as many ought to know, are planning to raise basic income tax deductions to $15,000 for those earning under $147,000 in 2015. As we should remember, They also increased the upper tax bracket for people making more than $200,000 a year. And so other things that they're trying to do is they want to plant a tax, I beg your pardon, luxury vehicles. Now, I'm not quite sure what qualifies as a luxury vehicle these days. And they also want to start taxing our tech giants that generate revenue in Canada. So I imagine that would include Facebook, Google.
So these are like
Amazon.
E-commerce types
So I mean, that's, you know, most people's attention gravitated to the, you know, the basic income tax deduction. Now, some of the criticism to that would be is, well, how many people is that really going to impact in Canada? But you have to understand, if you're raising the income tax deduction levels, the government's losing money, right? The bottom line, they are losing money in that regard. But in terms of who they're taxing and how, the details are there in the plan, and that's one approach that they're doing. On the other hand, Andrew Scheer's Conservatives, they're promising a universal tax cut of 1.25% over 3 years in taxable income under 47,000. Now, that number is important because now they're going after a specific segment of the population, right? They're trying to identify the Trudeau Liberals as those being, how can I put it in the most efficient way possible, only out for the rich and the wealthy or their special interests, whereas the Conservatives are the party of the middle class, you know, trying to get them ahead and whatnot.
But so that's not actually what their policies do, right? Because, I mean, it's just the ones that you just mentioned now. The Liberal one would benefit those mostly like who are in the lower income brackets, right?
The impact to them
would be greater.
Yeah, it just depends
on how
the
Conservative one would actually help more of those who earn more.
It just depends on how we package and sell it, right? I mean, these are just, this is mass advertising that they're going for. Another element that they looked at in the Conservative platform was to make EI benefits for new parents tax-free. They want to remove GST from home heating costs. I can tell you firsthand, that's really not going to impact my bottom line. But the one that's interesting to me, they want to bring back the Harper-era public transit and children's fitness and arts tax credits. Now, this one is a bit of a problem because not everybody can make use of these tax credits, right? I mean, you have to be of a certain
age. The kind of people who can are the ones who have some disposable income to be paying for these programs in the first place.
And that is the great evil of a tax credit that people have to be made aware of. No matter who is promising a tax credit, the thing that we have to understand is who is it targeting, but more importantly, who cannot benefit from it. And that's the great issue here. And now they're also stating that similarly, like the Liberals, they're going to tax online tech giants, but they're going to impose a 3% tax on revenues. And the one that interested me, I'm not sure how this is going to work. Maybe you can explain this in terms of harmonizing laws. They're promising a single tax form for Quebecers.
That
kind of threw me for a loop. I'm not quite sure where that plays. Now, the NDP, they want to increase capital gains from 50 to 75%. That's consistent with their approach. That's how they want to fund their infrastructure. They want to increase the top level federal personal income tax from 33 to 35%. They want to impose a 1% wealth tax on those making more than 20 million. And they also want to go after Netflix, Google, and Facebook, much like the other parties. And those entities seem like an easy pinata for each political party to strike. You know, we have to go after these corporations that are not paying their fair share of taxes in the country. So similarly,
I'm actually okay with that.
I know, but
that part of it,
but
like they should pay something. I mean, they should, like, it's, you know, I guess because they have set themselves up in a way that they are, you know, from elsewhere. Like, I think the internet has definitely created certain new challenges, right? In terms of making sure that companies are paying their fair share.
Right.
And, you know, this has been overlooked for a long time. So I'm actually okay with them going after them. But I don't think the Conservatives plan to do that. I think it's the Liberals, the NDP, right? That's their
thing. No. The Conservatives, they support taxing web giants. That's how they put it. Oh, I beg your pardon, the NDP.
But
the Conservatives have made some allusions to doing that, but the NDP and
right. No, but what I'm saying is, like, in terms of in this election, like with a concrete
You're correct.
Plan. It's the Liberals and the NDP. It's not the Conservatives aren't going after those kind of corporate. Yeah, okay.
Now, the Greens have a really interesting thing, something that I had not considered. They want to find a way to tax cryptocurrencies, which is, I have friends who are involved in discussing this type of policy development, but it's interesting, but it's not as prevalent or more.
I was going to say, how big a share of, like, I mean, I don't know, maybe I've just stayed away from these types of things, but I don't think it's really.
Now, much like the other parties, they're also, you know, they're going after the corporate tech company, tech companies like Netflix, Google, Facebook, Airbnb, to try and impose corporate taxes on them. So the Greens are consistent in their approach to taxation in many regards to the NDP and the Liberals in terms of who they want to go after and what their red lines are for action. The PPC, well, they want to cut corporate tax rates. That's not a surprise. And they want a simplified two-bracket federal income tax where everybody who pays more than $100,000 would have a tax rate of 25%. And we don't need to spend very much time on the problems with flat tax levels because that introduces a lot of revenue issues for government when we move to a single tax rate for incomes. Something for another day, maybe, or get an economist to discuss it. They'll be much better placed to discuss that. So that's, you know, just some brief highlights on taxes. Mm-hmm. So over to you. What have you got?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so healthcare. So interestingly, there's some similarities actually between what the Liberals are promising and the NDP, some differences too. So the pharma plan, the universal pharmacare plan, is one that both of the parties are putting forward. It's just the way in which they're going to do it is different. So the Liberals are allocating $6 billion over 4 years, and then they will negotiate with the provinces. Their start time is a little bit further out because they said there's just no way, practically speaking, to make it happen any sooner. The NDP are saying, no, we can have this in place by the end of 2020. So as a reminder, we're kind of towards the end of 2019. So like in about a year, the NDP are suggesting that they'd be able to roll this out. I mean, personally, you know, someone who's worked in government and understands how much work and negotiating has to go into something as significant as this, that is a complete pie in the sky kind of date. Like, it's not realistic at all. But in addition to that, the NDP are also offering this universal dental plan. I think, in a way, I mean, I'm open to dental care being brought into something publicly funded, but I'm not sure universal makes sense in the sense that if people have private insurance on that, then, you know, that should be the first step just from an affordability perspective. Like the drugs thing, I get it, you know, because drug costs can be so disproportionate to, you know, your income, even if you are a high income or like middle income earner or whatever, right? Like that, I think it makes a lot more sense. But something like dental care,
means tested would be a good thing for dental care. And I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to do, right? Means tested qualification, depending on your income. And that would be equitable, I would suggest.
Exactly. And that's sort of where I come down. But, you know, the NDP are suggesting, you know, we can have a universal plan, et cetera. It kind of goes with the same theme, you know. I mean, obviously my interpretation of their whole platform is showing through here and that, you know, I think they have good ideas in utopia, but, you know, in reality, we can't do everything. We can't pay for everything. We have to make choices. Mm-hmm. And I think with this, you know, that's where they're a little bit off. The Conservatives have a line in their platform where they talk about, you know, that they will open up the options for private healthcare options, that they're going to make it easier for there to be that. And in terms of the drug side of things, they're going to be focusing on orphan drugs and that are targeted more at rare diseases. And I think that's not a bad thing, but if we have a universal drug plan, then that should be incorporated within that too, as the other parties are suggesting. So the Conservatives are being much more targeted in their focus, but also opening the door to private options. And that, I think, for some people should be something to be concerned about because, you know, when you end up in a two-tiered system like we have in the U.S., it can really, you know, disadvantage your everyday person who won't be able to afford it. It can also have an impact on the quality of public health care. I mean, there are a lot of pros and cons. I mean, it can work in some places. Like, for example, in the UK, they do have a public and a private system, and their private system isn't quite as robust shall we say, or as extreme as what we see in the US, but,
right.
It's the opposite, actually. In the UK, it's like mostly public and there's a little bit of private. In the US, it's like mostly private and tiny bit of, public. And it's sort of, the quality can vary and so on. But the mixed systems can work somewhat, but they're always pros and cons, right? And I think in Canada, that is a big, big shift for us. And I'm not comfortable with the way that it was just sort of slipped into this platform that, the Conservatives released at the last minute after the debates. I think that's something to be concerned about.
Yeah.
In terms of the Greens, I did look at them a little bit. They also said that, yes, by 2020, they would be able to have the universal pharmacare out there. But their plan is, like, from a financial perspective, completely out of this universe, and not in a good way. They're saying that, they will fully fund this from the federal purse, not necessarily share it with the provinces, and that it would cost $27 billion in year one and up to $40 billion by 2028. I think that was sort of the assessment of their plan, that, just from a cost perspective, that it's just really quite extreme. And I would also put in the unrealistic camp, but that's what you have for healthcare.
Okay. Do you have any others? I mean, I'm done at those three. I have some facts and fictions that we could move on to if we're
I have just a few that I'll just mention. I mean, okay, so civil rights. Now here, there's really only one party to focus on because it's the CPC is proposing something that is just so shocking. They're gonna designate terrorist hotspots certain countries. Like, they're gonna take whole countries,
designate them as
terrorist hotspots.
Right.
Yeah, and then essentially say that any Canadian who traveled to these hotspots, that there's a reverse onus on them to prove that they went to that country for legitimate reasons. And quite frankly, that's not constitutional. That's just not going to stand. There are going to be challenges if they put into place something like that. And it's also following Trump. This is another example of Andrew Scheer following his idol, Donald Trump, with a policy like this. And it's so offensive, and it's, another example of them, infringing on civil rights.
Wow.
There is no comparison with anything that the Liberals or the NDP or the Greens are offering, and to compare here, is just the CPC. Like, they're the ones who are proposing something that is clearly going to be unconstitutional. There's going to be a court challenge, and it's,
it's clearly targeting a certain group within Canadian society, right? It's clearly,
for sure.
It's clearly targeting Muslims. That's all it's doing.
Yeah.
Let's be frank about it. It's going to target, you go to Pakistan, if you go to Saudi Arabia, Iran, any type of region, which is...
They will pick certain countries that
I'm sure will be similar
to the list in the U.S. But then there will also be some inconsistencies there, even the U.S. list, it's just... It doesn't make sense on many fronts, and I think
Are they going to put France on the list? Are they going to put the UK on the list? Are they going to put India on the list?
Right.
Are they going to put China on the list? The list is endless. Right. If you're going to open that up, you better just be sure of what you're doing. And when I saw that, I was, how can one put it, rather shocked at such a blatant form of it's discriminatory, and it's not going to stand up to scrutiny in any shape or form.
No. So yet another example, there were many under Harper of when the CPC were infringing on our civil rights. And this is another example of Scheer doing that. The only other topic that I just want to quickly touch on is the boil water advisories, because this has been something that I think there's been some misinformation about it, actually, mostly from the NDP, where they have said that the Liberals have done nothing about it, should have been done yesterday. And it's true. This sort of thing should have been fixed a long time ago. Even before the Liberals came in 2015. But the reality is it wasn't. And there were many, many, many hundreds of boil water advisories across the country in reserves. And since the Liberals came into power, about 85 of them have been, these boil water advisories have been lifted. They've been, in order to lift them, there's obviously some work that has to be done.
Sure.
Sort of from an infrastructure perspective. So it's not like you can just snap your fingers and they're lifted. There's work that needs to get done. So the Liberals are saying they're on track to lift the remaining advisories by 2021, which is just over a year away. And the NDP are, you know, they haven't really outlined a very concrete plan as to how they'll make it happen yesterday, but that's their thing. I mean, they're obviously committed in the right way to make it happen, but it's unclear how exactly they would do it any faster than what is currently already being done, right? The resources are there in place that are working towards this. I'm not sure what the NDP are going to be able to do to make it happen faster. But that
snap
is their commitment.
Their fingers.
I think so. There's the magic words while they're at it. Okay. The CPC, they have made no specific mention of First Nations. That's one of the criticisms that Perry Bellegarde has made against them. Mm-hmm. But they have sort of very general words about Indigenous issues and kind of working towards good things and whatever.
I'm inclined to say that's a bit of a throwaway statement. That's what I would be inclined to call that. But
yeah, exactly. It was a lot of fluff. Mm-hmm. And not much specifics. And, you know, that's what you get with the Conservatives. So that was the only other one I just wanted to highlight. Yeah, right. So let's move to these. We're going to skip the fails of the week just because we're in the election period and we've said a lot already about the platform. Mm-hmm. So let's focus then on the fact or fiction.
Okay, so I'm going back to the 2011 federal election. Canadians' reasons for not voting in the 2011 federal election. The most cited reason was, I'm simply not interested. Was that a fact or is that fiction?
I think that's fact.
You are correct. That's a fact. 27% simply stated they weren't interested in the election.
I think, you know why? Because we had so many
we did.
Elections.
There was fatigue. You're right.
Yeah. After Harper came in with his minority, right? Because like, 2011 is when he got his majority.
Yeah.
So there were, I don't know how many elections, but there was. I mean, there was definitely voter fatigue. So that, yeah.
Now, do you want to take a guess at to what the second most cited reason was? I'll give you a list. There's three choices here. There's either illness, out of town, or too busy.
I'm going to say out of town.
Too busy at 22%. Oh.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know,
it's similar to the first one, right? Which is like, couldn't care the less. Yeah, I was too busy doing other things, right? Like,
these data, they're from Stats Canada, right? So I'm not making these up out of thin air. This was reported data.
No, okay.
Okay, so my next second of three. The first woman to head a government in Canada was Kim Campbell in 1993 as the prime minister. Fact or fiction?
Head of government, not head of state, right? That's what you're saying?
Head of government. The first woman head a government in Canada was Kim Campbell in 1993 as prime minister. Fact or fiction?
Okay, so then that also would include like premiers. We didn't have any female premiers at that point. I think that's fact.
That, my friend, is fiction. In 1991, Rita Johnson was the premier of British Columbia. She was the leader of the Social Credit Party. That's a question I floated out, you know, as a trial balloon in classes before. And yeah, it's overwhelmingly.
Okay, so it's like 2 years. It was only 2 years
is.
Prior.
It is.
Okay,
so my last one. Here we go. Now, twice in Canadian history, we have had a situation in which a government has controlled 100% of the seats in a legislature. Fact or fiction?
Okay, so I know one of them is correct because you told us that one, the 1987 one,
mm-hmm.
right?
Good recall.
So then the question is there another one?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that seems like kind of extreme, but I will just go with fact.
It is a fact. It's an East Coast thing. PEI in 1935. Oh. I'm stretching back. I understand. But there you go. It's only happened twice. It just goes to show you, even though we do have these perverse outcomes using the electoral system, these are really outlier cases.
But exactly. It's rare. Yeah.
Right? So those are your three factor fictions for this week tied into, you know, electoral systems and voting.
And so hopefully everyone has voted already in the advance voting or will be going out to vote on the 21st, which is Monday. It's important to have your views heard in the election through your vote. Don't do what people did in 2011. Don't be bored by this election. Don't be too busy. So just, you know, if you haven't voted, get out there and vote. I think we're probably preaching to the converted, anybody who would have listened to this podcast anyways.
Sure. Okay.
Next time on Matter of Fact, what we'll do is we will focus on Brexit because 10 days after our election on the 21st, Brexit is supposed to happen. And that whole scenario has been quite the ride, as most people will know. And I think it'll be useful for us to go through it. Prof S is actually from the UK.
It's giving me an existential crisis. What's going on?
Exactly. And I used to live in the UK as well. I grew up there until I was 2. Then I lived there again as an adult. So I have some connections there. I have some family there, lots of friends there. So for both of us, we have a certain interest in this topic. And I think people generally are interested because it is such a bizarre turn of events in Europe.
Absolutely.
So that'll be our next segment for the next matter of fact. In the meantime, have a good week. Happy voting. And we'll see you in a short period.
This is fun. The FU Network.